And now, with Sound Investing, here's Paul Merriman.
I've got a bunch of questions I want to respond to on this podcast, and I hope that you find them of interest. Several of them are quite interesting to me, but before I dive into those, I would like to share a little bits of a conversation. I'm not going to tell you the name of the person I spoke with because I'm in the process of finding out more about this gentleman and will hopefully be involved in a podcast with him so that you'll get to learn more about him. But he is what would be considered a coach, a financial life coach. And at the same time as I had this lengthy conversation with him, I got an email from an organization, a website called Napkin Finance. And what I like about the Napkin Finance work is they take topics and visually, with graphics and a few words, explain financial types of process and products, etc. And it just so happens that this week, this particular one is dedicated to financial advisors, you know, who they are, what they do, how they help you manage your money. And I like the way they do it because they show the range from what they call less regulated on the left all the way on the right to more regulated, and we will include a link to this particular Napkin Finance Money Simplified graphic. But anyway, let me share with you why I find this particularly interesting. What has happened over the years is that the idea of being an actual financial planner it's relatively new. When I went in to the investment business in the 60s, and I was a broker for a few years, really what your work was about was getting on the phone or in person and recommending some investment that the brokerage firm or the broker or some newsletter somewhere, whatever, a really great investment that was going to do certainly better than the market. And by the way, when I got into the business, we didn't think in terms of indexes and beating the market like the S&P 500 or the small cap value or large cap growth. Basically, it was the Dow Jones that was the center of attention. But today we have this whole range of people who can help you, and I think it's important to know about these people because they all potentially could have a place in your life. Now, when I talked to this fellow who is a coach, a financial planner coach, and he's not licensed, he's not an investment advisor, he's not a broker, he is a coach. This is not so unlike there are therapists, psychologists, and they're licensed, and then there are coaches and people who help folks get through some of the same challenges as a therapist would, but it's a different level of required licensing, as I understand it. I'm sure somebody's going to correct me on that one, but in the case of a financial planning coach, they don't recommend individual securities. They don't place an order to trade anything that you might have. They're not involved in that investment process except in a very generic way. Having said that, I can tell you, having spoken with this very bright, very caring fellow who wants to help folks with their decisions, not just financial, but also business and planning decisions for the family. He's got a great heart. He's got a lot of experience. And the question then comes, how does he decide who to recommend give the guidance for the for that investor who isn't likely to do it on their own without some additional help. And this coach can, in fact, give a lot of that help, but he just can't say, put all your money in the Vanguard target date fund that represents your retirement date. Now, I suspect they can gently push people that way, but they just aren't legally allowed to give specific recommendations. They could, though, say, look, here are a couple of newsletters you could subscribe to that are relatively low cost. In theory, I would like it if this coach would say, go read Paul Merriman's website, and he's got recommended portfolios there that you might find apply to your situation. So there are places that this coach could send people. They could also send somebody to an investment advisor. I would certainly hope they would not send somebody to a broker, a registered representative, a salesperson, basically. But that's another category of where you can get help. And brokers aren't evil people. In many cases, they're in that part of the industry because they really enjoy the challenge of picking stocks and being in the ups and the downs of the market on a daily basis, being involved in those IPOs, those initial public offerings that are all very exciting and offer opportunities for short-term profits. There's still a demand for that kind of help. Plus, a lot of folks are sitting on individual stocks they've purchased over the decades, and now they need some guidance, and they can look to a broker who theoretically will have some way to determine whether you should sell it or buy more or hold. So that's another place you can go. And when I was a broker for a couple of years back in the 60s, we were not expected to give financial planning advice. People appreciated it if we did, but typically you go to the trust department of a bank and you had to have a fair amount of money to get some sort of planning. And of course, now things are very different, and planning is available everything from going to the major mutual fund companies, which they didn't do back then, or going to your broker to get planning, or going to a robo-advisor to get planning, or a CPA, etc. So this range of experts, so we start with that coach. The brokers can do it. The only reason I'm sensitive about brokers, and this is not me thinking they're evil, they aren't evil by nature, but they have potential conflicts of interest. In my book, Get Smart or Get Screwed, How to Select the Best and Get the Most Out of Your Financial Advisor, I think I have a list of 80-plus reasons that I don't want to do business with a broker. And it's all different ways that they may be impacted by that commission. The third level of help is the investment advisor, the registered investment advisor. And these folks are not in the business of buying and selling individual securities. That doesn't mean they don't do that as a part of their investment management, but they are seriously into financial planning. I actually don't think I know an RIA anymore that is purely devoted to investment. It's possible, but not very many of those. Now, in this graphic, the next level of advice that Napkin Finance mentions is the CPA. And under the CPA, they talk about the tax advice. Well, the fact is that there's a designation called the PFS, the Personal Financial Specialist, and that is the theoretical equal to the Certified Financial Planning designation in the non CPA world. So a CPA can be the equivalent of a CFP, and many of them are CFPs, but they can also be a PFS, personal financial specialist, plus they're able to give tax advice, which is a big deal to get all of that in one product. And then the last thing they note here on this graphic is the lawyer. And it says they take care of legal issues and taxes. And it is not unheard of that financial planners, these are large ones, will in fact have a lawyer on their staff to help people with estate planning documents and if not on their staff, just right down the hall. So you've got the coach, unlicensed, likely dedicated, maybe not as experienced in the financial part of the world as somebody who's a broker or a registered investment advisor, but there's never a commission in the process. In fact, they're not licensed to give investment advice, but they can lead you to places where you will hopefully get efficient investment advice. And then, of course, there's the broker where we've got the problem of the commission payments, potentially. Many people are dually licensed and can earn money either as an hourly guy, expert, or as a percentage of money under management, or a commission. And then there's the registered investment advisor. Their compensation can be hourly. Just got off the phone a few minutes ago with an investment advisor out of the Medford area. From our conversation, I would say he is well-versed on how to give good investment advice. And not only does he take a percentage for people who want him to work on a percentage of the assets under management, he'll also work for folks. And in fact, he charges $300 an hour. And when people come in and all they want is his hourly help, he said he has rarely, if ever, charged over $900, which means that it's unusual when it takes any more than about 3 hours to give that advice on what people should be doing on their own. And of course, with the CPA, that is going to be hourly. Or, by the way, CPAs can also have, as a part of their business or a connected business, a registered investment advisor where they can work on a percentage of money under management. Hopefully, the CPA is not taking any money in commissions. I think that would be, from what I know about what CPAs believe, I would find it shocking for a CPA to be taking commissions. I got a lengthy email from an old friend who has been using the strategy at Vanguard that we recommend. He made an interesting comment. He mentioned how different asset classes can be in terms of return. And in fact, he said, I'm just amazed how asset classes differ in return each and every year. I'm especially fascinated with the Callan tables, C-A-L-L-A-N, which I would never have known about if I didn't tune into you. He's an old-time podcast listener. And if you haven't seen the Callan periodical table, C-A-L-L-A-N, I suggest, in fact, we'll put a link to that in the description of this particular podcast, because it can truly be amazing, the movement from the being the very best to being the very worst in comparative returns year to year. And the table is wonderful because it's colorful, so you can immediately see where different asset classes end each year with a quick look at a particular color, which represents an asset class. The one that he mentioned, He says, even though value is not performing recently, I'm so glad I have 10% in, and this is a Vanguard REIT index fund. And he says it's up over 28% year to date and a 3+% dividend yield. I think actually when you see the increase in the price, at least at Morningstar, it is going to include the reinvestment of any dividends paid during the year. But then he goes on to say, on your podcast today, you mentioned four bond funds to juice up returns, juice up in quotes. I'm just concerned about the additional risk of corporate bond funds. I listened to another podcast in the past month, and the guest mentioned that corporate debt is the biggest risk in the market these days. Now, it doesn't really matter what that risk might be, but because this in this particular case, it's somewhat technical, and I'm not sure that it is in fact the risk that Don heard on this particular podcast he listened to. But here's what I know about corporate bonds. Corporate bonds, long term, going back to 1928, have compounded at 5.8%. Now, that's investment grade. And the U.S. government long term bond has compounded at 5.6%. So you've gotten 0.2% additional return for the long corporates, which are more risky because they can't say government guaranteed. So you're getting a premium. It's not been a big premium. At the same time, now that spread, if we look at the Vanguard long-term government bond fund, it is paying 1.5% versus 2.8% for the long-term corporate. So if there is additional risk in these corporates, it is showing up in a premium return that is over 1%, 1.3%, which at least historically is very high. So Don's question is it worth this higher risk? Well, you know, that's something you have to contend with, because if you tried to get 2.8%, you could get that in dividend portfolios, high-yield dividend portfolios, at even higher risk. And, of course, the risk in the portfolio of stocks that pay dividends of 2.8%, they're going to have the risk of a loss of half of their value, theoretically, in the next big bad bear market. And so that is always the push and the pull of making that decision, how much risk, how much return. But here's a point that I would make that I think is important in making this decision. Why corporates versus governments, or why governments versus corporates? Well, the reason I recommend governments inside of an IRA, for example, where taxes are not a consideration, what I'm looking for from those governments is not a higher dividend payout or interest payout. I'm looking for more stability. When the real bad things happen, when the catastrophic market arrives, there tends to be historically a huge rush to quality. For example, in 1987, the day the market fell by 22%, there were bonds that were up over 16. And so there was a huge rush at that moment of catastrophe to the governments, and a bigger rush to the long term. So for people who are looking for higher interest to come out of their investments, then that monthly income portfolio is okay. But if you're looking for stabilization, I wouldn't use the corporates. I would use the governments. Next question comes from somebody who wants to know, where is the market going? They got money to invest. Of hearts, they know they're likely going to lose money if they put it at risk today. Now, I have covered this many times. It is the most common question that I get. And this is the case where I just wish I could sit down as an advisor or as a friend and know more about their history of investing. Because people who tell me, I am worried if I put my money in the market right now that I'm going to be at very high risk and have very low expected return. In fact, I really believe I'm going to end up losing money, if not forever, certainly for an extended time. And the reason I'd want to have that conversation is because typically when I run into that kind of a question posed in that way, I want to know what they did in 2008. I want to know how they responded to that decline. Did they get out in 2008, or did it take the further big declines in the first quarter, the first part of the first quarter of 2000, of 2009, before they decided to cut the loss and to cut the pain and to find a safe place to be? Because if in a conversation we find out that that person has a history of having this feeling of the market going down or keep going down if they're not in, if they get in, or to keep going down if they're in, and they don't know what to do. They're panicked. It's that I can't stand it anymore feeling. So I've tried. I remember a fellow out of Southern California, Hines, such a nice guy, really, just a sweetheart. But he could not control his emotions regarding the market. He was never happy, drove his wife nuts. I begged him to just go put your money in CDs. Ladder, a series of CDs. This is the same person who is always afraid he's going to lose money, who found out friends of his had made a whole bunch of money with a very high-risk strategy that was being managed by somebody who wouldn't even be paid unless you made money. But when you made money, they made 20%. But they did take inordinately high risk. And Hines was able to overcome his fear of losing a lot of money because, one, this person had made a lot of money for his friends. Well, yeah, he made money for him in a market that was going up. And the person did not have a strategy to protect the money when it went down, so Hines got in. And then the market went down, and he lost big time. Oh, I forgot to say, the person who does this uses leverage. So here is an investor who claims to be afraid of the market at the top, afraid of the market at the bottom, probably afraid of the market in the middle, probably should be in CDs. But because some friends made money with this person, and again, at very, very high risk, it was just too good for Hines to pass up. Well, you already know the rest of the story. It was catastrophic. And even after going through that, and by the way, the person who did this to them was doing it illegally because she wasn't even registered to manage money for others, let alone to be taking a 20% of the profits. I mean, The story goes on and on, but you get it. There are people, if you talk to them long enough, you will find out they should not be in the stock market ever. Or if they do, to go in with a strategy that they can live with in the worst of times. We've talked about our fine-tuning table. And if somebody really can't take the risk of the market, they should look at the fine-tuning table and see that they could probably make an extra 1% or more if they simply put about 30% of their money in equities. And the worst periods of time would be probably, hopefully, livable. So one answer to that whole situation is, if you want to go in the market, go ahead and go in the market, but have very little money in equities, have the rest in fixed income, and a combination that when you look at the fine-tuning table, and I'll have a link to that as well, you can see how much you would have lost in the worst of times. Here's the next question. I don't take these kind of questions because they require that I know a lot more than what I'm being told. And I certainly am not in the business of talking to people on the phone and going through this kind of discussion. But I'm going to share this one with you because, one, it's kind of interesting, and two, it will show you the thousands of different answers there could be to how this person could solve their problem. So this fellow who writes to me, he talks to me about some other things, but then he says, okay, now the background on the buddy I'm trying to help. Well, I'll bet you it's possible that he is the buddy he's trying to help, but doesn't matter. It's still a story that's worth sharing. He recently sold his business, and after taxes, he will have about $1.2 million, clear. It's in cash. He wants to retire and create a steady income from his $1.2 million. He doesn't plan to work anymore. He has a couple of hobbies that he wants to devote his time to, both woodworking and fishing. My buddy is thrifty, drives an old car, and owns an older house. I feel he could budget wisely and make it work. The only concern I have is he's only 38 years old. Would the Vanguard monthly income portfolio be advisable for someone this young? And for those of you who didn't listen to the last podcast where I talked about that monthly income portfolio. Right now, it's returning a little over 3% and will likely return a lot better, more in the future. So, you know, maybe this guy could live on 3% of $1.2 million. But there's more. The guy does have $565,000 in a solo 401k. One reason that I have a suspicion the buddy is the guy who's writing this email is he mentions the fact that it's a solo 401k, which is the kind of thing you might say about yourself, but not somebody else. Anyhow, according to this email, he doesn't plan to touch it until he's 70. So he's got $565,000 that could sit there for 32 years before he touches it. And he's got $1.2 million that he wants to produce the income right now. And then he does say that he plans on drawing his Social Security at age 70. Then he goes on to say that he suggested that he study our website and have a good look at the best-in-class portfolios. Anyway, I believe my friend has the potential to be in really good shape. Do you think the monthly income portfolio would be the right fit for his $1.2 million, considering his age of 38 and that he has no plans to go to work again? And does he have And again, he does have $565,000 in retirement plans, where I believe it will be invested to grow until age 70, when he can tap into it as well as his Social Security. Well, I mean, there are, I mean, literally, okay, it's not 1,000 choices, because he probably wouldn't want to read 1,000 choices, but at least a couple hundred. But think of this. If you were this person's advisor, what might you want to know? You might want to know what kind of risk the person took. How much money did he put into his $565,000 solo 401k? Was that all in equities? Would he want to put $1,000,002 all in equities? Well, whoever wrote this email thinks he should be considering the monthly income portfolio. And by the way, the person theoretically could put that $565,000 into an all-equity portfolio for 32 years, but they probably won't have the risk tolerance now that they're no longer working. But they could put it into something that would compound at 6%. And if it compounded at 6% and he didn't touch it for 32 years, it'd be worth about $3.6 million. In the meantime, he can struggle along with this low-risk fixed income portfolio, which, by the way, would mean that overall he'd be about one-third in equities and about two-thirds in fixed income, but he could be in those bonds. And if he took out 4% a year of that original amount, $48,000, I don't know if that'll cover his cost of living, but he says, my buddy is thrifty, drives an old car, and owns an older house. I'm guessing he's single. I'm guessing he doesn't have any kids. I'm guessing he doesn't have parents that might rely on him. I'm also guessing that he really doesn't want to work for the next 32 years or thereafter. But here's what I know. If he takes that $1.2 million and takes out 4% a year, $48,000 a year, and I'm going to say it again, I think that he'll do better than the 3% in those bonds over the rest of his life. But at the end of 32 years, if he took out $48,000 a year, and that, remember, he doesn't owe any money on his house. He buys old, in fact, I don't think he's going to have money left over. He's going to wonder what to do with all the extra money that he's taken out. But at the end of 32 years, if you make 3%, you take out 4, you still have about $570,000 left over, which means you could take out a little more probably. What if you took out $50,000? Well, I'll just run that one through my calculator, and that would leave with about $465,000. My point is that he could invest the $565,000 very conservatively, let's say 50-50 stocks and bonds, might get a lot bigger return than 6%. Don't know, but if he got 6% with that conservative portfolio, and then he put the rest of the money into bonds to take money out of, almost like a pension, he'd be in fine shape. And so you can see, you could slice and dice this in hundreds of different ways, because the person has money that he doesn't have to touch for 32 years. You could put it all equities, but you probably shouldn't. But if you did, as I said before, you'd have about one-third in equities and two-thirds in fixed income. Again, a conversation with somebody like this is what you have to do. And I think about this guy that I talked with down in Medford, Oregon. Charges $300 an hour. it wouldn't take too long to figure out what this guy has and what his risk tolerance is. And let's say it took $900 out of his $1.2 million he's sitting on right now to put together a portfolio that will more than likely, if he is this very frugal guy and doesn't have kids and ex-wives or a wife to have to try to work out this with, should leave him with tons of money to leave to good causes after he passes. So, no, I can't help this guy because I don't know enough and I don't want to know any more than I already know because I'm not allowed to do it in the first place. Next question. I just listened to your March 27th podcast where you mentioned the underfunding of state pension plans. I thought you would find this article interesting about what the Wisconsin system is doing to protect their pensioners. And I did not read the article, but I'm hoping a lot of states will figure out how to do things to protect their pensioners. It's a big problem, as I think most of you know. But then he goes on to say, unfortunately, I am not one of them. He is not in an environment where he can get a pension. He said, that's the problem when you are self-employed most of your life. Well, the fact is, we can all retire with a pension. You don't have to work for a big corporation or the state to get a pension. You can simply put money away yourself instead of having the company put it away for you. You simply reach into your own income and you pay yourself first before you cover your cost of living. And that money is being put aside so that the same thing that happened to your friend who works for and has a state pension, that you can create your own body of money that when you retire, you simply turn it into a pension with a single premium life annuity. You can go get that from Vanguard, for example. And if you want to test the waters and find out maybe where you might get more, you can check with Stan the Annuity Man, probably the best source of low-cost annuities in the country. He's online. He looks very, very serious on his website. He's actually quite a nice, nice guy. But he looks almost evil. He's so serious. But here's the important thing. You can put money into a single premium life policy. It will guarantee you, just like the pensions guarantee their pensioners, the state or the corporation, a particular monthly payout. And you don't have to worry about the market going up or down. The insurance company has made that guarantee. Now, you want to do that with a high-quality insurance company. It's the same with corporations. Most of them just turn the money over to an insurance company or more than one, to make those payouts. But you can control that yourself. And it doesn't mean you have to do that with all of your money. You can do it with enough of your money that it and Social Security are going to take care of most of your cost of living. Now, that means that you have to oversee the saving. But in essence, those people who work for the state or who work for those corporations, the state can afford to pay them more right now. They could, but instead they've set it up so it goes into an account that will pay a pension out later in their life, partly because they know that if they gave them that money, they'd probably just blow it in a lot of cases. Not all cases, but a lot of cases. So yes, you can have a pension. And the older you are, the more they pay out. In some cases, for people in their 80s, the payouts in these pension funds are huge. 8%, 9%. That's because those people aren't going to live very long. And remember how a pension works. You die, it dies. And they get to keep the rest of the money. Now, you may have a second-to-die pension plan so that if you die, then the survivor gets to receive an amount. Now, you'll get a smaller overall amount because potentially the insurance company is going to have to pay out for a longer period of time unless you die together in an auto accident or something. But it'll be the same. You can do the same thing with that single premium life annuity. You can do a second to die there as well. Now, if you try to retire at age 30 or 35, the single premium life annuity isn't going to pay very much. It'll be a very small amount because you're going to likely live for a very long time. Next question may start to sound like, how do I invest at the top of the market? But it's a little trickier than that. And I think it's a legitimate question. Because here's a 35-year-old, graduated from the university right before the Great Recession in 2008. And he's only now able to start saving some money. In fact, however he got there, he's presently sitting on about $100,000. He's had that money in cash for a couple of months while he's trying to figure out what he does about his investment strategy. And he goes into some information about how he will probably invest, which all sounds very fine, except his question is, would you suggest a different strategy for someone like me? Now remember, 35 years old, and already went through the big recession in 2008, and finally has some money to invest for the long term, but he, like so many people, is worried about the big recession. Well, he's actually okay with the big recession. He would like the big recession to happen, in a sense. I mean, he didn't come out and say that, but he said, I do have money to invest when the market goes down significantly again. He says, I'm in a unique position to invest heavily when the market is in recession, but it means holding out, waiting to see what happens. I understand, he says, we can never predict the market, and over 30 years it may not be a big difference, but with everything I'm reading about the market right now, it seems crazy to throw all my savings into the stock market at this moment. Maybe patience will help me avoid a huge loss right out of the gates, and he'll get this chance to buy these asset classes at a very low cost. He says, I'm already behind in my finances because of the unfortunate timing of graduating in 2008. I don't want to be a victim of poor timing again. And by the way, luck, good or bad, is in fact a huge part of how you do. But here, this person has the ability to wait. And he says, I know you've analyzed the markets over 70 years, and you can see the difference between those who started their investment strategy right before a recession compared to during and after. So what should I do? He asks. Well, let me give you an example. I know a couple who sold their house in the summer of 1987, but they didn't get the money until just right before the crash, where the market went down 22% in one day. And so does it make a difference when you invest? Well, it's huge, because these people felt so relieved that they hadn't put the money to work. So when they finally did put the money to work, the market was down about a third from where they could have put the market money to work. A third. That's a big deal, because instead of starting your portfolio with a value of $1.5 million and then it goes down to $1 million, then let's say it doubles and becomes worth $2 million. Well, if in fact you invested at $1 million and you put $1.5 million in, now you got $3 million. So, does it make a difference? It is huge. The problem is nobody knows how to make the call except to say, well, it's obvious the market is high. Yes, it is obvious the market is high. It is obvious if you do an internet search that you will find people who will talk about huge losses coming. In fact, one of those is the big bubble is going to be because of index funds are going to cause the bubble. Look, we don't know, and in fact, normally when we end up going through a huge market decline, the reason is something we didn't exactly anticipate, or we certainly didn't anticipate the timing. And the reason I say that is already that's happened, because the market is way higher than people thought it was going to be more than several years ago. So that was a huge mistake too, in terms of the guess of which way the market was going. But when the market goes up, we forget about the fact that we made that huge guess before already, that it was going to go down, and it didn't go down. So we just ignore that bad decision that we were about to make, but maybe didn't. How confusing is all that? So what can a person like this do? Well, the one thing we know is they probably have here the potential of funding. I don't know how much this person makes, and I don't know how much they could put away into their different retirement accounts they have available to them, whether it be the kinds of, you know, the IRA. In this particular case, this person is a Canadian, so they have a different strategy there. And then there's also money they can put into what would be the equivalent of their 401k plan through their company. The same set of choices in a way. So what about this? What if you just inherited this money from Aunt Jane, and you loved Aunt Jane, and you know that Aunt Jane would want you to do something really good with that money that would feel good? Maybe it would be to travel for 3 years around the world and gain wisdom, or maybe it would be to fund your retirement with that money, because potentially what you could do is you could use this money to fund the next 4 years of retirement contributions. Now, that would be a good deal. And then you hope the market goes down year after year. Now, of course, you could have held it back for 3 or 4 years and wait for the big decline. But let's say you wait for the 50% decline and it goes down 30, or you wait for the 30% decline and it goes down 20 before it turns around. And there you're sitting. The market turns around at some point, but it didn't get down to your magic number. And trust me, whatever you do, it's not going to be perfect, or you are going to do what we consider kind of the equivalent of winning the lottery, because you can just get lucky. So I think my recommendation would be to use that money to dollar cost average into your retirement accounts starting at 35 isn't all that bad. If you can put away $25,000 a year, now you can do it right now for 4 years. And if the market is terrible, that's great. You're going to be able to pick up some cheap shares, and then you continue putting away money on an annual basis as much as you can. I would think you ought to have a pretty substantial retirement. That's the kind of strategy I would look for, something that doesn't cause you to do anything dramatic, and that you pick a combination. As a matter of fact, I think you've said here that you're thinking in terms of a combination of small cap value ETF along with a target date strategy. I think that would be a pretty smart thing to do. I think I'm going to make this the last one today. I'm getting ready to go down to Charlotte to make a presentation. Very excited to see both the older people at AAII and the younger people at the Choose FI gathering. Both of those, one Saturday morning and one Saturday afternoon. This is going to be fun. Well, let me close today with a question from Jimmy. Jimmy says very simply and with a few words, in your opinion, does an actively managed mutual fund perform better in a down market than passively managed ETF? And I would have to say that I would expand that to include passively managed ETFs as well as index mutual funds that are 100% committed to the market. Now, to be fair, we can't make the judgment only on how the strategy does during the bear market. You see, mutual funds will oftentimes, actively managed ones in particular, be sitting on a lot of cash. They'll be in cash in good times, they'll be in cash in bad times. So the first thing I would say is that I would expect that the actively managed funds, because they have some cash in hand, are going to likely look better, not because they were making a market timing decision, but because that's the nature of the way the money is managed, they will look better in a down market. But the bigger question is, when we go through bear markets and we come out the other side, who does better? And the answer is the passively managed funds. See, one of the challenges that an actively managed fund has is that the mental thought process by the investor is, I am in a mutual fund where the manager is going to protect me against bear markets because it's actively managed, can't get that in an index fund, and I'm willing to pay more for that protection. And then the market starts going down, and there are people who will, when they see they're not protecting against the downside, they're out of there. They liquidate, causing that actively managed mutual fund to sell their shares in things. In fact, oftentimes they have to sell shares in things they would really like to continue to hold. Now, other people will sell not because they're disappointed in the actively managed fund not having bailed out, but they're just market timers themselves. See, index funds generally, other than ETFs, but regular index funds do not allow market timers bouncing in and out of the market, but actively managed funds often do. But those people who are either panicking or who simply have a system that says it's time to get out, they're going to be selling shares in a actively managed mutual fund, and putting pressure on the manager. But again, the reason that's a problem is because when you have to sell a bunch of shares, and I'm talking about big volume now, oftentimes that can impact the kind of a price that you get for what you sold. And the shareholders take a hit because of somebody else's activity. But the people in an index fund typically are saying, look, I know these people aren't trying to get me out of the market. I know I don't want to get out of the market because I won't know when to get back in. And they tell me they don't know when to get back in. And they seem to manage a lot more money than I do. So I'm going to go with them. And I'm going to stay the course. Because in the end, the way that we should be measured as advisors is, or the mutual funds as providers of an index strategy, for example. Where did you end up from the bottom to the top? Let's say we looked from the beginning. Let's say we looked from the beginning of 2007 through the end of 2017. I'll do that. I just now thought about that, but that is one thing we could do. How did the actively managed funds do compared to the index funds? Well, we already know that the index fund beat over a very long period of time, probably about 90% of the actively managed funds. So we know that. What we don't know is how did they do kind of from the bottom to the top? Pardon me, from the top to the bottom, back to the top. That's what I'd like to know. And I'm going to do some research on that, and it won't be a big formal deal. I've got too many of those going on right now. But I'll take a look and see how the passively managed held up compared to the actively managed. See, the good news is, with each of these asset classes, Morningstar tracks the average return. So I'm going to be stuck looking at the average return of all of the actively managed funds. I'm not going to, in fact, it will probably overstate the returns of the actively managed funds because that average return is going to include index funds as well as actively managed. So what I know from previous studies that have been done is that the passively managed funds have done better in declining markets than the actively managed. Passively has outperformed active. But again, that's from top to bottom. Let's look from top to bottom and back to the top. Because remember, the day that market turns, The active manager who's sitting on a bunch of cash is likely not to position themselves totally in equities right at the bottom. They're going to be sitting there watching for maybe a change in trend. And one of the weaknesses of any market timing that is based on a change in trend means from the bottom, you're going to have to wait. You're going to give up the best returns from those very, very strong days that often happen off the bottom. Well, I hope somewhere in this podcast there was a lesson worth learning. I appreciate your time with me. And again, as I have asked, there are so many ways you can help our organization. And one of them, and it's a powerful one, is to share links to things that you think others might learn something from. So thanks for doing that as well.
That was Paul Merriman with Sound Investing. Sound Investing, soundinvesting.com, and paulmerriman.com are produced and exclusively owned by Paul Merriman, who is solely responsible for their content. For more information, free articles, mutual fund recommendations, and more, visit paulmerriman.com.